Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Before we get to today's guest, who has a really fascinating story about his time in the submarine force during World War II, I just want to pass on my condolences and best wishes to the family of Richard Wing, who passed away this past week at the age of 89, one of the neatest veterans I ever had a chance to interview. His story was so different. He passed out on a 25-mile hike at Camp Roberts, realized he had an irregular heartbeat. The Army stuck him in the kitchen. He became a cook. And before you know it, he became the personal chef of General George Marshall, traveling all over the world and then parlaying those experiences later into a world-renowned restaurant in Hanford called Imperial Dynasty that won several awards, even served presidents of the United States over the years. And Richard owed all of that to his time in the service during World War II and that exposure he had as the personal chef of General George Marshall. A great man, a very special man, and a lot of his memories are preserved at the General Marshall Museum in Leesburg, Virginia. So that legacy lives on, as well as his great family there in Hanford. So I just wanted to share that with you briefly, and I'll post some information and maybe even an old video with Richard Wing on our website at kmjnow.com, where you can also read about today's guest, Arlen Johnson of King City, a little west of Hanford on the 198, a lot west of Kalinga even. King City, California is where Arlen joins us from today. And I mentioned that he was in the submarine force, but I don't think you were thinking about submarines growing up in Kima, Texas, between Houston and Galveston. You probably weren't, were you? Absolutely. You know what? For some reason, my recording isn't picking up your voice here. I don't know why that is. I've got it. Well, let me check. Let's see now. Talk to me.
How's that sound?
Oh, there
now?
It goes. A different button got pushed, I think. So now we should be okay.
Okay.
And you know what? I'll save that other stuff for the end. I'll just start over and get right to you here. So since it wasn't recorded, I'm going to start over. Here we go.
Okay.
3, 2, 1. Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes. We're with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. If you've never heard the program before, the idea is pretty simple. The idea is that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, there's a hero nearby. Maybe someone who doesn't think of himself as a hero, but someone who is willing to put his life or her life on the line for the freedom that we enjoy every day. We focus on veterans of World War II. We want to preserve their stories, want to honor them for their service and sacrifice, and hopefully along the way inspire some of the rest of us to live up to this great legacy that what's been called the greatest generation is giving to us. Arlen Johnson is a member of that generation. He's 88 years old, originally from Texas, lives now in King City, California. And Arlen, growing up in Kima, Texas, between Galveston and Houston, I don't think you grew up dreaming of spending some time on a submarine now, did you?
No, I didn't. We had a lot of water around Galveston, of course, in the island, but I never dreamed of that at that time.
You're more probably a Cowboys and Indians guy, I bet, down there.
You're right. Now, yeah, we enjoyed it. We had a lot of fun as a kid.
Now, you actually joined the service before Pearl Harbor Day. What struck you and what made you want to join the Navy in 1940?
Well, 1940 is, we were working on the ranch. We had some cowboys on the ranch, and one of them was telling me how great the service was. You could go in and save some money and come out and buy yourself another ranch. So it seemed logical in those days. And it was an adventure more than anything, too.
A simple equation, huh?
Right.
Well, it's worked out pretty well for you now, but it was certainly an adventure for you. And by the end of this program, we're going to hear about some of Arlen's adventures on the submarine, the USS Tilefish. He had one situation where he was on the top of that sub and it submerged, so that ought to be entertaining. We'll also hear how he earned the Silver Star. But you signed up in 1940. Of course, everyone knows what happened December 7th, 1941, and I have a feeling you haven't forgotten where you were when you heard the news of the attack on Pearl Harbor.
That's true. See, I was in Pearl Harbor before. We left Pearl Harbor about a month or so before the Japanese hit, It was the 8th Cruise Division. I was on the Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And we went around through the canal, and I got off in Boston. And in the meantime, the Japanese had hit, before they hit Pearl Harbor, I had a buddy on the Arizona, which went through the training station with me. And I went over in Arizona just when we left. It was a big old ship. It was an enormous ship. And I received a letter from him afterwards. The Japs had hit Pearl, and he was killed in Arizona.
Mm.
So that was the start of it. And then I was signed to a little minesweeper that was built in Oregon. It was a patrol boat and a minesweeper all in one. So we were escorting the tankers up and down the coast and minesweeping the entrance to San Francisco Bay.
Well, I'm sure that provided some interesting days, too. And I'm struck by what you just shared with regard to the Arizona. And obviously, everyone who was an American, let alone in the service, was impacted by December 7th, 1941. But that one touched really close to home for you. And having been on the Arizona just a month before it sunk, I bet that was kind of a surreal feeling when you saw the photographs and saw the news footage and on the newsreels and realized what had happened.
That's true, because I hadn't been away that long. So, anyway, I put in for submarine duty, and he came through and volunteered for it. And they sent me to New London, Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
and submarine school, which I completed. And then we had to go through the school and our rating. When, at that time, I was first-class signalman. So they I changed my rating to first-class quartermaster, because the quartermaster was what I really liked better. The signalman was okay, but the quartermaster was more in the navigation end of it.
Well, and everything that you're saying is putting a lot of questions in my mind, but I do want to ask you one more, if I can, about the Arizona, just because anyone who's been to the memorial knows how moving that can be, and I'm curious if you've ever had a chance to go to the USS Arizona Memorial at Pearl Harbor, and if so, what it meant to you with your personal connection.
That's right. We've been out a couple of times to it since the war, and the harbor has changed quite a bit, and it gives you a funny feeling when you look down there and think that battleship is down there under the water, and all the guys that I knew on there. But the harbor changed so, in the days before Pearl, the harbor was full of motor whale boats.
Mm-hmm.
When the fleet came in, everything was done by motor whale boat to the shore, back and forth, supplies, what have you.
Right.
And now it's so completely different. But you still see the mountains there just like it was in the old days. We used to sleep on top side when we anchored in there because it's so warm down below.
Exactly. A lot of guys did. And that's how a lot found out what was going on that Sunday morning, December 7th. I've read quite a bit about that. Well, that really is something with your connection there, and I imagine that gave you plenty of motivation, as if you needed any more.
Yeah, we were pretty well motivated, all right. The submarine force was quite unique type of military service. It was a little different. When I was on the cruiser, it was 2,000 men on there, and then when I got on the minesweeper, we only had about, I don't know, 35, 37 men or something like that.
Right.
And then when we got onto the submarine, we had about 60 men.
Well, and I'm curious, you said that you put in for submarine duty. Now, I've had guys in the Army say you never volunteer for anything in the Army. Why would you want to volunteer for a World War II era submarine that if it's under and you get hit, you're toast? That it has to surface every day just to recharge the batteries. That's such a far cry from the submarines we have today. I mean, did it seem at all like a potential death trap to you, or was that part of the intrigue for you?
Well, at that time, see, that was the latest thing we had,
mm-hmm.
you know, to go to war with, and I was ready to go to war.
So it was the potential excitement of the task at hand that made you want to do it.
And, and also the, on the sub, you were, it's a different type of climate you're under. Camaraderie. The officers and men are much closer.
Well, yeah,
and
you
men
can...
are close, real close on a sub, because you're like a family.
And you don't get off the ship very often, do you?
Not very often.
Maybe a little more often in those days than some guys do now on submarines that can stay submerged virtually forever.
Well, I didn't get off very much, I'll tell you that. I only remember going home maybe one time.
Now, I'm sure that you're familiar with what the technology's like today. Maybe you've even stepped on more modern submarines or certainly seen them in movies and on TV. For those people who aren't familiar with what the technology was like during World War II, how would you describe a World War II-era submarine in contrast to what we know and see today?
Well, you see, we had the latest boat in those days. It was built in Maryland, and we had the latest information on, like, radar and sound gear and that sort of thing. But it was all being improved at the time. It was just the starting of the... No, the radar we first had, it was near as good as it was later. And the sound gear the same way. And the communications, everything improved as we went along. But when we went to sea in the first part of the war, we did a lot of cruising on the surface at night for looking for enemy ships and that sort of thing. And we could work into the convoys, and their radar wasn't any good. We were ahead of them on radar and sound gear too. But as the war progressed along, they got better and better.
Sure, technology was improving day by day, and this was the USS Tilefish, SS-307,
right?
The Balau class submarine,
right. We had about 60 men on there, and our patrols were somewhere around 60 days.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, the dropping-off point into the Pacific was Midway Island or Johnson Island down south, where we topped off our fuel when we came out of Pearl. We usually had 2 weeks in the hotel at Pearl while the ship was being revamped for the next war patrol. But before every war patrol, we had to go through an extensive training session before we were qualified to go on another war patrol, because the men were changing. We'd get some new men aboard, and of course, 2 weeks at Pearl gave us a lot of time off. So we had to get back in the saddle, in other words, before we go on another war patrol. So it took several weeks of training before you could get back onto another war patrol.
Well, and these were powered by diesel and electric. And,
right.
And you had to surface how often to get that charged back up?
We had to surface every night.
Mm-hmm.
See, we were down 12, 14 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And we would surface after dark, usually. And then we'd go down at daylight.
Gotcha.
In the early part of the war, that was a procedure. The aircraft was so bad in the daytime, you almost had to be submerged.
Absolutely.
As the war wore on, we had a little bit more latitude, it seemed like.
You weren't so much a sitting duck anymore.
Unless you were chasing a convoy or something, and then you had an air cover on it, usually.
Well, it sounds like there are some stories there to tell, and we're going to get them from Arlen Johnson today. Right now, we're going to take our first commercial break. When we come back, we'll hear about his adventures on the USS Tilefish, a submarine in World War II. We'll hear how he earned the Silver Star, and about that time where the ship went under and he was still above the surface of the water. That ought to be really interesting. Arlen Johnson, 88 years old, of King City, California, is our guest today. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, talking about submarines today. Nothing like you'd see in the Hunt for Red October or one of these TV shows. World War II era submarines had to surface every night. That was the case for the USS Tilefish. And a quartermaster aboard that ship by the name of Arlen Johnson, who's our guest today. He's originally from Texas. Now he makes his home in King City, California. Received a Silver Star during World War II. We're going to talk about that. But why don't we continue, Arlen, by talking about your first war patrol. I imagine there was some anticipation among the 60 guys on ship leading into your first war patrol where you thought you might be taking out some Japanese ships.
That's true. You know, when you first go on a submarine, even though you go through schooling and everything, you know, a submarine school, you still have to qualify on a submarine to stay on it.
Mm-hmm.
So each man has to qualify, and they give you a lot of examinations. You have to know just about everything the guy does on the boat. You got to know where all the tanks are, how the engines start, the engines, as far as the torpedoes, just about everything. You get down to the cook. You have to qualify. In other words, once you're qualified, then you're qualified forever.
Gotcha.
You have to qualify. So on the first war patrol, you usually have quite a few guys to qualify.
Now,
this is kind of exciting. The first war patrol that you're on, is you never know what's going to happen. You know, it's kind of like an adventure.
Now, you were on the very first war patrol that the Tilefish made, correct?
Right. I was signed to it when it was built.
Mm-hmm. And so here you are, a quartermaster on that ship. What kind of duties did you have? If you were going to encounter combat or that kind of situation, what kinds of things would you be doing?
Well, you see, the ship has got a guy in charge of each compartment. And my compartment was the conning tower, with the quartermaster's conning towers, where all the action takes place. And my job on there was charts, navigation, chronometers. We had three chronometers, which you have to have the right time to navigate, you know. So the chronometers always have an error in them. You're responsible for that. And responsible for the error in the gyro. You have to make sure the gyro, your compass has got what the error is. If there's an error in it, pardon me. If there's an error in the compass, you have to correct it by sun lines,
mm-hmm.
and navigation. You have to shoot the stars every night and morning.
What if it's cloudy?
Well, we got what they call a DRAI on there, with a dead reckoning analyzer.
Right.
And you could set the latitude and longitude. When you get a good star sight, you set the latitude and longitude. And it had an input to it from the turns of the screws and the gyro and it kept a real good record where you were going and where you it kept it tell you where you was at. But the only thing it didn't do was it couldn't take care of the drift.
Mm-hmm.
So there was you could always have an error in the drift and it would get bigger as the time went by if you didn't reset it. So we usually reset it on a star sight.
And I don't know how often, if at all, you got to look through the periscope, but I heard some of those could be notorious for fogging up and leaving you blind, too.
That's true. We had problems on the first run with that. It fog up on them. And then we also had problems with them with binoculars fogging up.
Mm-hmm.
But I solved that one time by putting it in an air conditioning unit when they come down off of the, off the bridge. We put the binoculars in this little compartment, and it went back up. There's no fog in them.
Those are my favorite kind of stories, just the ingenuity that comes to you in the heat of the moment, an idea that certainly wasn't in the manual, but you came up with it.
But we had a lot of problems with the radar in the early part of it. We had we chased moonbeams at night with the radar. There was nothing there. It was those bugs they had to work out.
Well, I'm sure you guys were all pretty antsy to try to find some Japanese ships as you patrolled the waters east of Honshu, where that mission took you on that first war patrol. I read that you guys actually ended up diving below what you were supposed to, or the depth that you had tested out at?
That's right. It was a funny situation. We were right at the mouth of the Inland Sea of Japan in the morning. It was one of these mornings when the fog lifts, and then there's places where you can see. Mm-hmm. And we dove, it was getting daylight, so we dove there. And we hadn't been down, I don't think, a half an hour, and we picked up a destroyer coming out of the Inland Sea, and we set up on him real quick in the conning tower. You set up everything that goes into the torpedo data computer.
Right.
So we're just about to fire on the destroyer when out of the fog comes a big transport loaded with troops. And the captain says, "Well, forget that destroyer. Let's set up on this troop ship real quick." So we set up on the troop ship, and we fired three torpedoes. And he saw the first one hit. But after that, two destroyers hit us, throwing depth charges both ways.
What did that feel like?
Straight dive down. They got too much dive on the boat and went straight down. Couldn't pull it out.
Holy moly.
Yeah. And we passed, we were going to trying to get to 500 feet, and we passed up to 600 feet. We pulled it out. The executive officer jumped down in a control room, which controls the diving, all the diving, balanced stern planes and that sort of thing.
Right.
And he blew a bow buoyancy tank, which is a tank in the bow of the sub, and it pulled the bow up, and then we got on a level keel. We had to let the air out of it then because we were going back for the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So we let the air out. It gave a big bubble for the destroyers to bounce on.
Uh-oh. So now you're a...
They beat us for most of the day. We got out of there. But what happened was when we fired the torpedo, so you can hear it right through the hull.
Right.
When you hit another ship, you can hear the torpedo hit. And we heard the torpedoes hit. You can count the seconds. They know when you fire a torpedo how far away, how many seconds it's going to take before it hits.
Right.
And the first one hit, and then the second one hit, we heard a third one hit, but we don't know what we hit. On the two, we know we hit the one.
Right.
But we never got any credit for sinking that ship because we don't know what happened. But on the other side of the ship is coming out, there was more ships coming out. So those other two torpedoes, I don't know where they went. They hit something. They went off. But it took us all day to get away from them. They beat us pretty bad.
Well, that had to be pretty scary for you, knowing this is your first patrol. First, you're in an uncontrolled dive, and probably a lot of you think you're diving to your death, right?
Well, that wasn't the first patrol. That was one later. The first patrol we went on, we got into a convoy, and we sank a ship. It was in it. I remember going through that. We tracked it, got into the ship. Got into it. We took a beating on that one, and that was the first depth charge, and the guys all got used to depth charging.
Give us a taste, because maybe a few. We have some submarine veterans that listen to this program and maybe can identify, but the vast majority of us listening to you have never been on a submarine, certainly not a World War II era submarine, when depth charges were rattling it. What did that feel like inside that sub?
I tell you what, if they're close, boy, you don't want to hear them no more. If they're farther away, you can take them pretty good, but if they're close enough, you can even hear the detonator go off.
Oh.
And it really is loud, because you know what? Anything under the water is loud, but you get depth charges on top of you. It's pretty tough. But we had one time where it broke the high-pressure air bank inside the boat, broke behind the stop, and bled all the high-pressure air out into the sub. And when I opened the hatch that night, see, I was the first one up and the last one down.
Right, sure, as the quartermaster.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I opened the hatch and blew me right up on the deck.
You hit the eject
so much
button.
Pressure in the boat. But every time you go down, you put a little pressure in the boat. That's to kind of offset the pressure from outside. But you know, you get a lot of pressure when you go down. And the deeper you go, the more the pressure is. The deeper. That's what it'll crush you if you go deep enough.
That's right. And that's why, it, to me, when you described that steep dive beyond your test depth, that if I were on that ship, I would have been scared for my life.
Well, I don't know. I don't think we were smart enough to be scared. When I look back, it was quite exciting for a minute when you saw that depth charge keep the depth going down. And we have bound stern plane guys on there, you know, one of the bow planes. The guy had up on the bow plane, but it was still going down.
Exactly. That's a little unnerving. But like you guys, like you said, you weren't smart enough to figure it out, so I guess in that case, ignorance was bliss, huh?
Right. But in my job on the sub was mostly navigation, and it was always in the tracking party. Every encounter we had a tracking party. We had to set up a tracking. We had a little desk in the conning tower that had a right next to the torpedo data computer that we did our tracking. Sometimes we did it in the control room, but most of the time it was in the conning tower.
Well, so and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm just trying to picture myself in your shoes, and it sounds like from the duties you had and the spot on that sub where you were, that you were privy to just about everything going on, that you were in the middle of all the action.
Well, that's true, because we had the charts. We had it was in the compartment we were in. We had everything right there. The torpedoes right there in the conning tower. So it. It's about when you got the skipper, the exec, and a quartermaster, and you have a man usually on the helm, mm-hmm. and a sound man. It's in the conning tower. That's the group. The sound man is on the sound gear all the time to give you bearings, and you can hear an enemy ship is looking for you. They're sending out the. echo, so if it hits you and bounces back to them, it gives you your location and the distance to you.
Right.
But you can hear it very loud. It comes through very loud. You can hear them pinging on you.
Not necessarily a sound you want to hear.
No.
They know where we are now.
So when you fire a torpedo, you take a bearing. In the early days, we had to take a bearing through the scope. And then we had what they call like our is was on the scope. You had to cut the other target in half, and then you had to read this bearing down here to see what the distance is.
Sure.
And then you had to put that manually into the torpedo data computer.
Gotcha. But
and towards the end of the war, we had radar in the scope, and the radar, we get the bearing and the radar and goes into the torpedo data computer. And of course, that sends the information to the torpedoes and which bearing to run out on when you fire it.
So technology was advancing right in front of your eyes.
Right.
Well, we need to take another break, but when we come back, we'll hear more of Arlen Johnson's adventures on the USS Tilefish, a submarine in World War II. He's going to tell us why he received the Silver Star and about that time where the ship went under and he stayed up on top. That's going to be a lot of fun. Arlen Johnson, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, talking today about submarines. And just to put it in perspective for you, how dangerous a job it was to be in the submarine force in World War II, as you listen to Arlen Johnson talk about this 60-man sub, the USS Tilefish, that he served on. 52 American submarines were lost during World War II on those ships. 374 officers and more than 3,100 enlisted men lost their lives. And if you look at that in terms of the entire submarine force, that's 16% of the officers in the submarine force, 13% of the enlisted men serving on submarines in World War II died on duty fighting for our country. So that's something we don't want to forget. I know that's something that so many submarine veterans have committed their lives to making sure that memory is honored. I know Arlen Johnson is no exception to that. And Arlen feels fortunate that he didn't join that number when he could have a few times. Arlen, I want to talk to you about the incident that earned you the Silver Star. You have a letter from a name that some folks might recognize, Admiral Chester Nimitz. You think you could read that for us?
Oh, yeah, sure.
All right.
At the top, it says United States Pacific Fleet, flagship of the Commander-in-Chief.
Having a little hard time hearing you as you read there. I must have made you adjust the handset on the phone there. So maybe if you can speak right into the phone while we while I have you read that, that might sound a little bit clearer for our audience.
It says right at the top, United States Pacific Fleet, mm-hmm. flagship of the Commander-in-Chief, and the name of the President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief, United States Pacific Fleet, takes pleasure in presenting the Silver Star Medal to Arlen D. Johnson, Civilman First Class, United States Reserve. For service set forth in the following citation: for gallantry and intrepidity and action in the performance of his duty in the United States submarine during a war patrol of that vessel. His skill and high degree of efficiency were of utmost assistance to his commanding officer in conducting attacks which resulted in sinking enemy ships totaling more than 8,000 tons and damaging over 4,000 tons of shipping. His calm manner and devotion to duty contributed directly to the increase of the success of his vessel. His conduct throughout was an inspiration to all with whom he served and in keeping with the highest tradition of the United States Naval Service. Signed, the C.W. Nimitz, Fleet Admiral, U.S. Navy.
Well, that's a pretty nice letter.
Yeah, it is.
Those are some pretty flowery words he used describing you. How did
yeah,
that make you feel?
anyway, my job was to try to help the skipper as much as I could. And he would ask me a lot of times for an angle on the bow of the enemy ships, which I had two good eyes in those days. Now I only have one.
That's better than none.
I guess I helped quite a bit. You know, everybody in the sub has their duty. They carry it out very well. So I was singled out to get with the Silver Star in this particular situation.
Well, let's hear about that situation, because the words that he used in that citation for the Silver Star were pretty powerful. You mentioned the camaraderie among that 60-man crew, but you were characterized as an inspiration there. He mentioned the words gallantry and intrepidity, which has always been one of my favorite words for a number of reasons. He said you had a calm about you, and the manner in which you did it was in the best traditions of the Naval Service. So what did you do? What happened? Take us back to that day and describe the scene for us.
Well, I don't think there's any particular one thing, and in mostly all of the attacks we made,
mm-hmm.
I was in all of them. Pardon me. My throat's kind of messed up.
That's all right.
We had, of course, the navigation end of it was quite interesting, too. You know, and some guys on the sub never see the sun, you know, from the time we leave to the time we come back.
Right.
But I was fortunate enough to be on top a lot, on the top of the conning tower, that is, taking star sights and what have you. And we had lookouts up there at night. We always had one quartermaster and two lookouts in an OD up on top at night and went on the surface. That's all the people that ever saw the light.
One.
The guys down in the torpedo rooms and some of the engineers and electricians, they had never seen the light at till they get back off of war patrol.
And that can make you kind of crazy, too, can't it?
Yeah. Well, you got to live with 60 men in a little place. The sub is 310 feet long, but you're full of torpedoes and everything. It's quite congested. But we had some real good cooks on there, and we had a lot of good meals, I'll tell you that.
Well, and you all had the same meal every day, I suppose.
No, we had a big freezer to carry food in.
I mean, nobody, and I'm having a hard time hearing you there for a second, but all I meant by that was I don't think anyone was getting preferential treatment. The food you had on that sub was the food you had on that sub, right?
Right. It was good. We had good food. Towards the end of the run, we always run short, of course, you know. One time we practically run down to beans and rice. In the short hours, we had steaks of all kinds. We had ice cream machine. We had bakers that cooked at night, and you had an open galley. You could eat any time you wanted to. It was so different than the service ships I was on.
Well, the ice cream machine alone was a pretty good luxury. I've read some funny stories about about December 7th, where there were some ships that the sailors went overboard to save the ice cream bucket and make sure that didn't go overboard, and here they are helplessly on the bow of their ship licking ice cream as they watched the Japanese attack. But ice cream was a hot commodity during World War II.
You know what's so funny? I have to tell you, when we went on these meetings with the submarine group, they took us out on the new subs.
Mm-hmm. A reunion of your World War II
right.
Submarine buddies? Yeah.
And the captain was taking us through the boat of this nuclear sub, and I told him, you know, we're in the galley. I said, the ice cream machine used to be right over there, and he says, it's over there, right over there, and it's the same place. I couldn't believe it.
Some things change, some things remain the same.
Oh.
Sailors today still have the same priorities that they did in World War II. Hey, before we catch our final break, I don't want you to dodge me on this Silver Star thing, because I understand that it could be for the entire course of all the patrols that you made, and I believe that was six separate patrols on the Tilefish, correct?
Right.
But what do you think the actions that your commanding officer relied on you the most for were, or what maybe you're most proud of that you played a role in helping your ship survive and inflict damages on the enemy?
Proud of it. All the guys that served the board are proud of what they did. It's hard to say. On the boat itself, I was at home. It was my home for 5 years, I guess, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was right at home with the guys that had lots of friends on there. And I don't know how you would say. Other than doing your job right and doing it, and you know, right there with the commanding officer when we were in the tight spots that we were in.
Well, how about if I ask you this? What was the closest call you had in your time aboard that submarine?
Oh, boy, that'd be hard to tell you. I'll tell you one time it was quite interesting, the time I was left on top of the sub.
Let's save that for the end here in just a minute. But anything else where you were under fire, a mine was dragged across the outside of the ship, the depth charges came awfully close, or a moment where you actually thought this might be it for the Tilefish?
Well, it's hard to find one specific thing because there were so many different things. Like one time we had a torpedo go off in the... that is, the engine of it go off. They routinely torpedoes. Somebody, somewhere or another, started one up in the room, and it armed the head. You know, when the propeller starts so many turns, it arms the head.
Right.
So we had this torpedo inside the sub.
Oh, my goodness.
And it run. See, their water cools, so there's no water. It's running inside, so there's nothing but smoke. So they finally stopped the thing from running, but how are they going to get rid of it inside? The head is armed. they had put it in one of the tubes and figure out how much pressure to shoot this thing out with. If we shoot out too much pressure, is going to blow us up.
Holy moly.
But if we don't shoot it, put in enough of it, it'll hang up in the tubes.
So how did you guys get rid of it?
We were sweating for a while, but they figured out enough pressure to get rid of it, and we finally got rid of it.
Wow. Boy, I think anybody who's even watched an episode of MacGyver and seen him pull the red wire instead of the green wire can identify with how hair-raising that must have been for you.
Well, one time we went to this Japanese naval base pretty close in and dove, and we had hydrogen in the boat. I guess some overcharging batteries too fast.
Uh-oh.
And we had to surface immediately, so we surfaced real quick right alongside the Japanese base.
Uh-oh.
We opened the forward torpedo room hatch and started the main engines and sucked it all out of there real quick, and then dove before they knew they could do anything.
So they couldn't get their guns on you fast enough, huh?
No, we were down.
Did you guys wave to them, say bye-bye?
We had a wolf pack of subs one night, and we were chasing a target that was going pretty fast. And we're setting it up on the surface. We run on the surface 18 knots. So we set him up on the torpedo data computer, and we were on top side, because you can do that from on top.
Right.
And we had the admiral up there, the skipper up there, the exec up there, myself, and two lookouts. And all of a sudden, just before we was getting ready to fire, they turned the searchlights on us.
Oh, my.
And it was the blackest night you ever saw. And right behind it, they started shooting. And you could read a newspaper all over this bridge. And the first one down was the admiral. Flipped on the bottom ladder, and everybody piled on top of him. And when I got there to close the hatch, I'm standing on top of people, dogging the hatch down.
Yeah, they didn't want to let you in.
We went down like a rock, and that thing went by us. We figured it was a cruiser going full speed, because the time we got back to the surface, he was gone.
That sounds like a very inopportune time to be the last man through the hatch.
Yeah, right.
Boy, sure sounds like somebody must have been looking out for you.
Yeah, you know, I did have a lot of luck. When the guys jump down off the periscopes, when you dive, you only have a few seconds, you know, to get down.
Right.
And I saved two guys during the war, but they would go overboard if I hadn't grabbed them.
Holy moly.
See, and I can't go. I'm the last one down. I got to make sure everybody gets down there.
Yeah, so if you don't get them down there, you're not going down either, huh?
Right.
Wow.
So both of those guys at different times. You know what's so funny about it? The same submarine, after the war, I was reading an article on it, that in the same spot, in the same situation, right out here by the Farallones, by San Francisco, coming into Farallones.
Right.
They lost a man overboard, and the time they got him back aboard, he was dead.
Oh, and that almost happened to you.
Isn't that strange?
That's
the
something.
Same sub. It's tilefish.
That's really eerie.
Yeah.
Well, we need to take our last, we need to cut you off there and catch our last break. I apologize. But when we come back, I'm going to hear this story about you being left on top, not making it through the hatch, and see how you survived your way out of that one. Arlen Johnson, submarine veteran of World War II, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Just a few minutes left with Arlen Johnson. You know, I gave you some statistics earlier about World War II submarines as far as the casualties among U.S. submarines in World War II, but I didn't put that in perspective with the damages that those subs inflicted. Of the 249 American subs in the Pacific in World War II, 52 were lost, but the damage incurred on the Japanese fleet was huge in proportion. 1,392 enemy vessels were sunk by those U.S. submarines, and more than 5 million tons of shipping. So with 2% of the naval forces, the submarines took out more than 50% of the enemy losses in World War II. So that really is staggering, the work done by the men on submarines, including Arlen Johnson, who earned a Silver Star for his efforts. We've heard about that. But we keep telling you there was a time he was on top of the sub, couldn't get through the hatch, and was floating away as the sub dove down below. So tell us about it, Arlen. What happened?
Well, you know, in those days, the radar operator had orders to dive the sub if an airplane was in 5 miles. Within 5 miles, he automatically dove a sub, no questions asked. So it only takes a few seconds for a sub to go down. So we surfaced. We had just surfaced. And I went to topside, which was procedure there.
Right.
And then the skipper would come up if everything was clear, and then they would set the watch. Well, I went up topside, and everything was clear. It was a pretty calm day with no white caps. It just rolling sea. And everything was okay, and I told everything's fine. The skipper started up, and he just got up. He got his shoulders up through the hatch when the diving alarm sounded. They pulled the vents, and the green water just rolled right over him because we still weren't blown up. When you first surface, you float, but then you put the turbo blowers on, it blows you up higher.
Right.
So it went down fast. I mean, the water just rolled right over him. He just took the hatch with him down. He had to.
Uh-huh.
And the sub went down. The first part of the sub, the bow disappeared and go, and the green water rushed towards me. I started up the periscopes, and I climbed the periscopes up as far as I could get up, and the water lapped my feet when they stopped the descent of the sub. But the SD radar antenna was still up, and the periscopes were still up. And I stood there for, I don't know, it seemed like a long time. I had a chance to look around at all the open sea around me. And the airplane evidently went the other way.
Huh.
And so after a few minutes, they surfaced again. And as it came back up, there was a speaker on the deck. The captain asked me how I was doing and how it was up there. And I said, it's awful lonesome. Struck me so lonesome. All of a sudden, I'm with 60 men, you know, for 18 days, and all of a sudden, there's nobody.
Yeah.
Nobody but the sea.
And you never did float away. You were clinging to that periscope the whole time?
I was hanging on to it for dear life. I didn't float away.
Well, I think
I was getting ready to, though.
I suppose. Yeah, good thing they started rising at the right time. I'm sure everyone listening has a mental picture of this in their mind and probably one they've never envisioned before.
Well, thank you, Navigator. Whoever he was flying the right direction. He flew away instead of towards us.
Yeah, amen. Otherwise, you might not be telling me this story right now.
Well, we were way off. We were off the coast of Japan. I don't know. I probably would have never made it.
And I bet you got quite the reception when they opened the hatch back up for you.
Yeah, quite a bit, but there wasn't nothing else said about it. Just one of those things that happens, you know.
I don't think there are too many people that can tell that story.
I'll never forget it, I'll tell you that.
I don't blame you. Well, Arlen, we're running out of time, but I appreciate so much your willingness to share all of that with us today, and thank you so much for serving our country.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Arlen Johnson, 88 years old, King City, California. He's been our guest today. Join us again next week for another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.